The book of Psalms reminds us of the greatness of God.
God is a promise keeper. God knows what He's doing. Now, of course, we know that God is a promise keeper. We know He knows what He's doing. But what the book of Psalms does so wonderfully is help us emotionally connect with that truth.
The Psalms are undeniably beautiful, elegant, poetic, deep in meaning, a source of hope and encouragement for God's people through the ages. Hello and welcome to Renewing Your Mind. I'm Lee Webb. Today, Dr. W. Robert Godfrey joins us with his new teaching series, Learning to Love the Psalms. Dr. Godfrey is a noted church historian and a Ligonier Teaching Fellow. I had the opportunity to visit with him when he was here on our campus teaching this series, and I asked him what the Psalms are all about.
Well, in an overarching sense, I think the Psalms are about the goodness of God to His people, which leads to praise of God. That's the conclusion of the Psalter. That's the great movement of the Psalter. But sometimes the goodness of God is hard to see, and so some of the Psalms reflect on the crisis of faith, the crisis of suffering in the lives of God's people, and that evokes other kinds of responses to God in terms of appeal. So the Psalms are intended overall to increase our sense of God's goodness and our faith in Him, but they also give us resources when the goodness of God is not so apparent.
Well, with that, let's join Dr. Godfrey in the classroom for the first lesson in his series, Learning to Love the Psalms.
My sense is that in the church today, many Christians have kind of lost a sense of connection to the Psalms. There may be a variety of reasons for that. I think in earlier generations, when everybody used the King James Version, there was a kind of familiarity with certain phrases and rhythms out of the Psalter that drew people into the Psalms. There were church traditions that sang the Psalms a great deal. There were church traditions that regularly read Psalms in services. None of that, I think, is quite as prevalent today as it was in times past. And so my sense is that many Christians today are a little more disconnected from the Psalter than earlier generations were, and certainly, I think, more disconnected than we really should be. The Psalms are one of the great treasures that the Lord has given us as His people. I was at a conference a number of years back, and they were doing a little sort of warm-up game. It was a small gathering, and they said, "Now, we want you all to write down, what is your favorite book of the Bible?" And it was not an entirely Calvinist gathering, so I was a little grumpy and, thinking all these games are sort of silly. And so my initial Calvinist reaction was, should we have a favorite book of the Bible? You know, shouldn't we like all the Bible equally? And then I thought, all right, now, you know, stop that. Be more cooperative. And then I thought, well, you know, I ought to uphold the side. I ought to say that Romans is my favorite book or Ephesians is my favorite book. And then I thought, all right, no, this is just a game. Let's be honest for a minute. What really is my favorite book of the Bible? And as I thought about it, I realized, at least in recent years, it's been the Psalms. I've turned to them again and again. I've found tremendous help, tremendous comfort, but also tremendous challenge. I found them intriguing. And part of what I find intriguing about the Psalms is not only the wonderful things I find there as I read them, but also that from time to time I turn to them and I think, what's going on here? What does this mean? And I also realize that there are wonderful attractions that draw us to the Psalter. Maybe you have a favorite psalm. Usually in the English-speaking world, people's favorite psalm is Psalm 23. The Lord is my shepherd. We sometimes think of it just as a funeral psalm, but of course it's not. It's a wonderful psalm for every point in life. But I remember reading a beautiful poem that John Updike, the novelist, wrote about 6 weeks before he died. He knew he was dying of terminal cancer. And that poem he wrote was in part a meditation on Psalm 23. And the last lines of the poem quoted the ending of Psalm 23, and he began the quotation, "Surely," and then he paused and wrote, "What a wonderful word, surely. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever." And then he wrote another, "Forever." it's touching, you know. And what I found moving about the poem was that here's a psalm we all know, many of us love, and yet from a poet's perspective, he saw something that I'd never paused over. That surely was just a word I'd kind of rushed by in reading Psalm 23. So we have psalms we connect to. I'm from Dutch Reformed churches, and in the Dutch tradition, the favorite psalm is 103. That begins talking about all the benefits of the Lord to his people, and then a reflection on the brevity of life, but on the covenant faithfulness of the Lord. So there are these psalms that both historically but also today have very much connected with people, are beautiful, and of course represent a unique book in the Bible. Now, we know that all of the Bible is inspired, and therefore the whole Bible is God's word to us, right? But the Psalms are not only God's inspired word to us, but the Psalms are words God has given us to speak to him. I think no other book of the Bible is so completely characterized in that way. The words of God that he has given to us to speak to him. So there's a Godward direction to the book of Psalms, which is unique and therefore uniquely helpful, I think we can say, in the Christian life. And that's why I'm excited to spend a little time under this heading, learning to love the Psalms. I think we need to work at learning to love the Psalms. Up to a certain point, it comes easily and naturally, but then I think we have to apply ourselves to it. So that's what we're going to try to do. We're going to try to get a taste for getting a sense of the Psalter and how it works, both in terms of individual Psalms and in terms of the Psalter as itself. As I was thinking about difficulties with the book of Psalms and trying to get a hold of it, I came up with five difficulties. I thought that, you know, was a good number. It's always good for Calvinists to come up with five of anything. So why do we sometimes find the Psalms difficult? And the first thing that came to me was, usually when we try to interpret the Bible, when we try to study the Bible, we try to look at the parts in terms of the whole. When we read a chapter, when we read a verse, we almost unconsciously think, how does this relate to the message of the whole book? And so we recognize that having some grasp of the whole is going to help us understand the part we're looking at. But that's very difficult with the Psalms, isn't it? I think most of us look at the book of Psalms and say, well, isn't it just 150 poems? There is no whole. I think we treat the Psalter most of the time as if it was 150 poems that, like a deck of cards, have been shuffled and could be in any order at all. Throw them up in the air and rearrange them, it wouldn't matter. They're just discrete poems unrelated to one another. And therefore, it's very hard to have any sense of the wholeness of the book of Psalms. And that's one of the difficulties that I hope we can address, because I don't think that's true, that they're completely random in their arrangement. I think there is a wholeness that we can begin to grasp. Secondly, the Psalms are somewhat difficult because of their literary form. Most of the rest of the Bible is history, or it's a letter, or it's a prophecy. It's literary forms that we're somewhat used to reading. But the Psalms are poetry. This is what you're paying the big bucks for, these kind of insightful comments. The Psalms are poetry, and we live in a rather non-poetic age. I think most of us are not poetry readers. Most of us are not trained to think about how you read a poem. And if we read poems at all, maybe it's in Hallmark cards, which are not intended to be read over and over and meditated upon. Their meaning is kind of on the surface. But great poetry is profound. It requires meditation. So we have to talk a little bit about what makes poetry work to really get into the Psalms. I mentioned that the Psalms are not only God speaking to us, but they are words for us to speak back to God. So thirdly, the question arises, who exactly is speaking in the Psalms? What is the voice we're hearing? How do we identify with that voice? Should we identify with that voice? This is raised particularly in what have been called the imprecatory Psalms or the cursing Psalms. Should we as Christians use the curses of the Psalter against enemies? Or is that an Old Testament thing that shouldn't be used in the New Testament? And so that leads us on to the fourth question. What exactly is the relationship of the Old Testament poems to New Testament church life? How do we make that transition? This afternoon, I'm going to, Lord willing, talk about Psalm 52 a little bit, which David says he was inspired to write by Doeg the Edomite. So how is your acquaintance with Doeg? How important to your spiritual life is it to know Doeg? Should you come back this afternoon or find something better to do with yourself? Here's one of the questions. Now, there aren't all that many Doegs in the Psalter, but it does raise this question. What is the connection of Old Testament to New Testament and our use of the Psalms and our appreciation of the Psalms? The fifth and final point is the Psalms sometimes in their own individual development kind of take a zigzag course. And so you're left wondering, what happened here? Psalm 95 is a great example. It starts out as a great call to worship. It's often used, the early verses of Psalm 95, as a call to worship. It's very memorable. It's very celebrative. Oh, come, let us sing to the Lord. Let us make a joyful noise to the rock of our salvation. Let us come into his presence with thanksgiving. Let us make a joyful noise to him with songs of praises. Great. Isn't that a great way to worship? But if you read too far, you suddenly find this shift that you're not really prepared for as a reader. Today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as at Meribah, as on the day at Massah in the wilderness, when your fathers put me to the test, put me to the proof, though they had seen my work for 40 years, I loathed that generation and said, they are a people who go astray in their heart. They have not known my ways. Therefore, I tell you in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest. Well, suddenly it's not quite so good a call to worship, or at least it's not quite so much the call to worship we're used to, what happened? This joyful coming into the presence of the Lord and then this solemn, severe warning. How does this shift take place? How are we to understand it? How do we enter in to what's going on thematically? You know, in Romans, we're used to Paul following a kind of rather clear thematic developmental line. First, he talks about sin, then he talks about salvation, then he talks about service. You can outline Romans. But not only is it hard to outline the whole book of Psalms, but sometimes it's very hard to outline an individual psalm. And so I think some people give up. And we're not giving up. We're forging ahead. And we can't learn everything, even in the 12 sessions we'll have together, but we can learn a lot. And we can begin to get oriented. And I'm hoping to wet your whistle. I don't know, do whistles get wetted anymore? It's kind of old-fashioned expression, but I'm hoping to develop a taste for what the Psalter is, what it can be, so that you'll be interested to go on studying on your own. I say that the Psalms are like a gold mine. That means there's gold lying right on the ground. You don't have to do any digging. But the more digging you do, the more gold you find. And so I hope that will help us and direct us. So let's go back to some of these difficulties, these five difficulties I talked about. And first of all, the question of the relationship of the whole to the parts in the book of Psalms. Is it just an utterly random collection, or does it have some coherence? Does it have some organization that's important for us to notice? Well, the very title of the book, I think, suggests there is an organization. In Hebrew, the title of the book is the Book of Praises. The Book of Praises. And yet, when you read individual psalms, you discover rather quickly, don't you, that not all the psalms are praises. Some are laments. Some are complaints. There are a wide variety of genres, as they say, of styles, of characteristics of psalms. They're not all psalms of praises. So why is the book entitled the Book of Praises? Well, I think it's because there's a movement in the book. There's a direction in the book. As you move further and further through the book, you find more and more praises. It's not that the whole book is a book of praises, but it's a book moving towards more and more praise and to the culmination of praises, so that the last five psalms are marvelous psalms of praise, each beginning with the word and ending with the words, praise the Lord. So right there in the title of the book, there's already a suggestion. Some movement is going on in this book. Some organization is at work in this book. And then secondly, the book of Psalms in all the Hebrew collections that we have, no matter how old, is divided into five books. I don't know if you've ever noticed that in reading the book of Psalms, but in all our English translations as well, the book of Psalms is divided into five books. Usually, that's been pretty consistently ignored. Okay, it's five books. You know, that means Psalms 1 through 41 were collected at one time, and then, you know, the next section is collected another time. So you have five collections of poems from different times, and they're just put together. Well, I think if we really stand back and take a look, we'll begin to discover that in point of fact, there is a kind of movement. There is a kind of development in the Psalter. That these books are not random, and the contents of the books are not random. And since I'm only a humble church historian, whenever people say they're humble, you know they're really not. Since I'm only a humble church historian, I can't explain to you why every psalm is exactly where it is in the Psalter. But I do think after years of study, I've begun to get a feeling for why the books are organized the way they are and how there is some movement in the Psalter. So I've come up with titles for the five books. And the first book, it seems to me, can well be titled Confidence in God's Care. Confidence in God's Care. The Psalms in Book 1 are Psalms that tend to be personal, tend to reflect some distress, and tend to resolve themselves pretty quickly into confidence in God. So, confidence in God's care. I need God's care. I'm in some distress, and I have confidence that God will understand my cares and come and help. And so if you're looking for a psalm that might speak to you in some distress, many of them are distress coming out of spiritual conflict. There are enemies that are oppressing the psalmist, and he turns to God and God cares for him. But there are some psalms late in Book 1 that are psalms of people who are sick, and God comes to help. There's even a psalm for the elderly at the end of Book 1. I'm turning to that one more and more. And so there is this kind of personal quality to many of the psalms of Book 1, confidence in God's care. Part of the reason I think this is somewhat important is one of my frustrations with the Psalter is every now and again I pause and I think, oh, I read a psalm. It was really good. Where is it? And I hardly know where to even begin looking for it. Now, of course, we have concordances and all sorts of things to help us nowadays. But I think if we get a sense of how these books hold together, it's going to help direct us in different times as to where we're going. Book 2, I call Commitment to God's Kingdom. These are psalms that are a little less personal. The difference between Book 1 and Book 2 is not huge. But Book 2 is a little more community-oriented, a little more thinking about the whole people of God and how God is providing for His people, coming to help His people. And then Book 3, only 17 psalms, beginning at Psalm 73, is probably the emotional heart of the Psalter and represents a great crisis in the life of the psalmist. And so I call it Crisis Over God's Promises. And there are great psalms of distress in Book 3. Not all of the psalms are psalms of distress, but the most distressful psalms in the whole Psalter are to be found in Book 3. So in the really bad times, Book 3 is where you turn. And it's really bad times individually and personally, but also really bad times for the kingdom of God. You know, in a bad presidential year or something, you'd turn to Book 3. They are psalms where the heart is poured out before the Lord. And the heart is broken, in a sense. It ends, Book 3, with Psalm 89, saying to the Lord, you made promises that David's son would always sit on David's throne, and now there is no son of David on David's throne. Haven't you broken your promises? Now, there's no greater spiritual crisis than that, that to think God has broken his promises to his people. And so then book four is addressing this problem. What if God seems to have broken his promises? And book four, I call the book about comfort in God's faithfulness. Comfort in God's faithfulness. And what book four does is turn very much to reflect on creation and on God's covenant with Moses before David, and to say, no, God really does keep his promises. God really is powerful enough to keep his promises, and God always has kept his promises, and so we can have confidence in God and in his promises. And then book five, the longest book in the Psalter, becomes almost a review of Israel's history and showing how God has had a plan through all of Israel's history, including a plan for the exile of his people, and then a plan to restore the kingship and restore the people and fulfill all of his promises. And that confidence in what God is doing in history is what leads then to the great praises towards the end of book five. God is a promise keeper. God knows what he's doing. Now, of course, we know that God is a promise keeper. We know he knows what he's doing. But what the book of Psalms does so wonderfully is help us emotionally connect with that truth and presents us with words of honesty to God. I think one of the great things about the Psalter is it gives us words to God that we'd never dare say left to ourselves. We're too pious. We think it's pious to hide our emotions from God. Maybe it's because too many of us are British in background, you know, stiff upper lip, never show any emotion, you know, I'm just fine. Well, the psalmist is not always fine. He's not British. The psalmist is not British. And he opens his heart. He pours out his misery before God. And I think it's tremendously helpful to us as God's people. So we have these five books. We also, I think, have an introduction and a conclusion to the Psalter. I think Psalms 1 and 2 are an introduction. Psalm 1 is a personal introduction. Blessed is the man. And then Psalm 2 is the cosmic introduction. Why do the nations? And so it reminds us that the Psalter is both very personal and looks at the whole cosmos before God. And then we have five concluding psalms, those psalms of praise to which I alluded. So the Psalter is organized, I think, is structured in a way to help us find psalms, but also to see movement in the life and experience of God's people and to lead us on, to lead us through, and to remind us of the good times, the presence of God, the apparent absence of God, and finding God after crisis. So that's what we're going to be trying to do as we go along, to have a growing sense of that organization of the Psalter. And the next time we'll go and look at some more of those difficulties I sketched earlier in this lecture.
Well, it's always true, isn't it, that when we understand something more completely, we appreciate it more. Thanks for listening to Renewing Your Mind today. We're featuring Dr. W. Robert Godfrey's new teaching series, Learning to Love the Psalms. Over the course of 12 lectures, he introduces the structure of the book and then highlights several individual psalms. He shows us how to most effectively read, study, and understand this biblical poetry. For your gift of any amount, we'd like to send you this 12-part lecture series on two DVDs. We'll also include Dr. Godfrey's hardback book by the same title, Learning to Love the Psalms. By the way, the book and the teaching series are not the same. Dr. Godfrey examines different psalms in the book. Our number is 800-435-4343, or you can give your gift online at renewingyourmind.org. As Dr. Godfrey said today, we're a society that does not read poetry as a habit. We may be missing out on the elegance and depth of expression that we find in the Psalms. So request this two DVD set along with the hardbound book when you contact us today. Again, our number is 800-435-4343, and our web address is renewingyourmind.org. You'll find more Bible study resources on Ligonier's website and on our mobile app, and it's free to download. You'll have access there to these daily Renewing Your Mind programs, articles, e-books, blog posts, and more. Just search for Ligonier in your app store. Let me spell Ligonier for you. It's L-I-G-O-N-I-E-R. Well, tomorrow here on Renewing Your Mind, Dr. Godfrey will examine some of the difficulties that we find in the Psalms.
In the Psalter, we have all sorts of talk about the temple. Well, we don't have a temple. Or do we? We have a heavenly temple. And so many of the images that we have in the Psalter out of the Old Covenant now are fulfilled in a spiritual sense in the New Covenant and allow us to enter fully into the praise, the spirituality of the Psalter.
Join us Tuesday for Learning to Love the Psalms, right here on Renewing Your Mind.